The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
At the outset, I'm going to be honest. I don't think the Bible has much to say on the issue of ecology in the 21st century. Up and leave. At least not directly. Our evangelical commitment to the sufficiency of Scripture sometimes turns into an overcommitment, and we can make the Bible speak directly to issues it addresses only generally, tangentially, or not at all. And ecology is one area where we run the risk of hearing or making the Bible speak more loudly than it does. While the Old Testament does speak to environmental issues, we have to admit that it does so from the perspective of an ancient agrarian culture located in a semi-arid, dry farming environment. We run the risk of asking questions that the Bible cannot answer, questions that are peculiar to our moment in history, post-industrial, early 21st century Western cultures. We have our own set of questions, and we have to be careful when we ask our questions to the Bible, which is speaking in a very different cultural and societal and historical moment. So I approach this topic with reticence and encourage you to visit the seminar that my colleague Mike Kelly, who played the drums last night, the seminar that he'll be offering. I believe that he'll spend at least a few minutes discussing the problem of how or whether how or whether ancient agrarian texts can speak authoritatively to modern post-industrial societies. Now, having said that, let me now talk out of the other side of my mouth. While the Bible does not speak directly to us about modern ecological issues, we may still eavesdrop on its conversations on related topics and ponder how this might help us in thinking about the question of how we are to relate to the environment in the early 21st century. In other words, what I'm going to try and do is enter the Israelite worldview and make some extrapolations from there into our own situation. Now, the announced title of this message is, What is Dominion? Well, why this topic? Well, it's supposed to cast you back, of course, to Genesis 1, 26 to 28, which we looked at last night, where God says, Let us make humanity in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over all the earth. It's supposed to cast us back to that text and invite the question, what is the nature of the dominion given to Adam? But now, for better or for worse, and I'll leave you to judge that, I've decided to narrow the focus of our time together just a little so that our discussion will more obviously connect to the topic of this conference. So my new title is Understanding Him to Be the Gardener, an ecological perspective on Adamic dominion. And hopefully in the following minutes, some of the allusions in that title will become less elusive as we go along, I hope. Most discussions about ecology and the Bible understandably begin with this passage from Genesis 1, Genesis 1, 26 to 28, the cultural mandate, because this is the text that is understood to speak most directly and most principially to the question of humanity's relationship to the environment. Now, I will talk about that text, but I want to do so in the context of the bigger picture that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 paints about the identity of the first humanity. In particular, I want to take two dimensions of this broader picture. The first dimension of this broader picture is the portrayal of Adam as a king. And well, I'll try and explain how I get there. And what I want to do is I want to work out from that starting point in an ecological direction. I want to work out from the idea that in Genesis 2, the creation of Adam should also be understood as his elevation to kingship. That's where I'm going to work from as I move in an ecological direction. Once I've done that, I'm going to come back and reflect upon the ecological dimension of what it means for the first humanity to have been created in God's image and likeness. So first picking up the idea of Adam's kingship, and then come back and look at this question of what it means for humanity to be in God's image and likeness. But first, a quick word on the relationship of Genesis 1 and 2, because I'm going to squash the two together. I understand these chapters to tell the story of creation from two different but complementary perspectives. Genesis 1 describes the creation of man. The Hebrew word is Adam. Now, I'll tell you the Hebrew word, and the reason I tell you that is because that should sound like an English word that you know, Adam. That's where the word Adam comes from. It's simply the Hebrew word Adam. And in Genesis 1, Adam is defined not as an individual, but as a collective. It's a collective singular, better translated as humanity or mankind. In chapter 2, the creation story is retold, but this time the focus falls on an individual, not the corporate Adam, the collective Adam, but the individual Adam, the human, the man, or simply Adam. In other words, in the opening chapters of Genesis, Adam is doubly defined, both as a collective, humanity, and as its single representative, the man, the human, who is the quintessence and the individualization of the species known as humanity. Now, understanding that will explain why I slide back and forth between Genesis 1 and 2 as I do. What I am assuming is that what is true for the collective, humanity, is also true for the individual, the human, Adam, and vice versa. Now, the first image I want to draw your attention to is the way that Genesis 1 and 2 depicts Adam as a king. Firstly, in Genesis 1, God creates humanity, man defined collectively, in order that they might subdue the earth and have dominion or to rule over creation. This is the language of kingship. This is royalty language. Although humans are themselves creatures, the Lord elevates these creatures above the rest of creation so that they might rule over it on his behalf. God rules over the world, but he's going to do so through one of his creatures, and that is the creature known as Adam, humanity. Humanity is the creature who is king of creation. And by the way, this is exactly how Psalm 8 interprets Genesis 1, 26 to 28. It describes the character, the king, as it were, of Genesis 1 as a king, one crowned with glory, ruling over creation and all things being in subjection to him. So Psalm 8 understands this passage in very royal terms. Then humanity's royal status is emphasized in Genesis 2, when the focus now narrows to the individual human, Adam, the human. And three elements in this story suggest his royal status, although I admit that for modern readers, the royal imagery may not be immediately apparent. The first bit of information is the fact that Adam names the animals, Genesis 2, 19 and 20. And it's long been recognized that name-giving in the ancient world was primarily an exercise of sovereignty, of command. So in Genesis 2, the means by which Adam demonstrates his dominion, his kingship, over the rest of the created realm is through the apparently innocuous task of naming the animals. Doesn't look very impressive, but it's an indication that he's king over creation. Even more subtle is a description of Adam's creation. Now, I want to draw your attention to the fact that Genesis 2:7 does not say that God formed Adam from the ground. What it does say is that God formed Adam from the dust of the ground. The difference is small, just one word in Hebrew, but it's very significant. Very significant. Unfortunately, I don't have time to prove my case, so I'm just going to have to assert that in the Old Testament, the image of being taken out of or lifted out of dust is enthronement language. You might want to look at 1 Kings 16, 1-3. That provides the best example. But see, you might also want to look at Samuel 2, 6-8. The idea of being taken out of the dust is the idea of elevation, enthronement language. So an Israelite, reading this text, would probably understand the literal making of man also as the metaphorical raising up of a king. In other words, the creation of Adam is also his enthronement as king. Now there's a third and even more surprising indication of the royal status of Adam in Genesis 2, and this is where my analysis is going to take its ecological turn. The relevant verse here is Genesis 2:15. Then Yahweh God took the human and then he settled him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to watch over it, to care for it. In other words, Adam is identified as a gardener, one who works the soil and cares for the garden. By the way, don't think of a vegetable patch when you hear the word garden. It's more like what we would call a botanical garden or a botanical park, with a rich diversity of exotic plants and trees. In fact, the Hebrew word Eden, which is normally just transliterated as Eden, should, in the light of recent discoveries in the ancient world, should better now be translated with the word abundance. That's what Eden means, abundance, fertility. It's the garden of abundance. It's a garden of fertility. Now, I suspect that you hear that information and think, well, isn't that a nice rustic scene? Joni Mitchell, we've got to get ourselves back to the garden, that kind of stuff. But there's more, much more to it than just a rustic scene. As surprising as it is to us, to ancients reading this text, depicting Adam as a gardener sent the additional signal that he is being identified as a king. A couple of examples. In Mesopotamia, one of the epithets of a king was the title, the gardener. Moreover, the Assyrian kings in the first half of the first millennium BC, that's from about 1000 BC to actually 600 or thereabouts BC, they loved to boast about the general agricultural abundance that they brought to their land. And more specifically, they loved to boast about the pleasure gardens. The Akkadian word there is kirimaku. This is the pleasure gardens. Their gardens really like the Garden of Eden, that they loved to plant in their cities, and especially alongside their palaces. The Assyrian kings demonstrated their dominion not only by subjugating the surrounding nations, not only by building sumptuous palaces, but also by the agricultural and horticultural abundance that they brought to their lands. And the pleasure garden, filled with exotic trees and flowing streams, was the parade example of the king's life-giving role as gardener. It was visible proof that his wise rule ensured the fertility and the fruitfulness of the land as a whole. Now, this representation of kings as gardeners is not limited to Mesopotamia. Adam is the gardener king. He is a prototype of all kings who would come after him. Now, note also that Genesis describes the conditions of the earth before the creation of Adam. And it does so in terms of a twofold problem that needs to be solved. It's expressed this way. The NIV says in verse 5 of chapter 2, "No shrub of the field had yet appeared on the earth, no shrub of the field had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant of the field had yet sprung up." Actually, there are two types of growth, two types of plants being referred to here. The shrub of the field refers to wild vegetation that grows in the wilderness. And the plant of the field, the second clause, actually refers to cultivated grains like barley and wheat and anything that you would grow under in cultivated situations. The reason for the first problem, the lack of growth in the wilderness, is because it had not rained. Nothing grew in the wilderness because God had not yet sent rain on the earth. But Genesis also tells us that there was a different reason why there was no cultivated grains growing. Simply, it says, there was no human to work the fertile land. In other words, there's no man, no Adam, there to work the ground. In short, things are not right with the world. Creation is incomplete. Creation is defective, if you like, until the arrival of the gardener king. Only with the arrival of Adam can creation become what it was meant to be, productive, fruitful, and verdant. In the ancient world, the king is the one responsible for ensuring the agricultural productivity of his country. In Psalm 72, it's just one reflex of this tradition. When the king acts righteously, in verse 2 it says, then the mountains will bring prosperity to all the peoples. The idea that the mountains will be lush and the people will benefit from this. This grain will abound throughout the whole land, while the land's fruit will flourish like Lebanon. This is what will happen when the righteous king is ruling. The true king, who after Adam's failure, after Adam's fall, is David. David takes the place, that's a whole different story in itself. David takes the place of Adam as the true gardener king. David, and ultimately, of course, his successors. It's the king is the one who, as it were, keeps the world in ecological balance, who ensures its fertility and productivity. It's his righteous rule that does it. And it's against this background that it's not at all surprising that Genesis 2 understands that creation is not completed until the gardener king is created. The motif of Adam as gardener not only draws upon the ideology of ancient Near Eastern kingship, it's also closely related to the idea that the first humanity was created in the image and likeness of God. And here I step back into Genesis 1. Again, to be created in God's image and likeness, that's once again royal language. Kings were often describe themselves as being the image of the deity. And that's true also in Genesis 1 and 2. But these chapters are also making a more basic point. As bearers of the divine image, the first humans were created to be God-like creatures, human mirrors of the divine creator, gods with a small g. So it should not surprise us that Genesis 1 invites us to make connections between the creative work of God with a big g and his human image bearers. It's arguable that Genesis 1 introduces Yahweh himself, the Lord, as a divine gardener. In Genesis 1, 2, we're told that the earth, before God begins to act, is, as every creation, every translation puts it, is something like formless and void, whatever that means. But a much better way of translating the Hebrew word tohu vabohu, Genesis 1, 2, the earth was not formless and void, but better, desolate and empty. The creation story does not begin with an earth as a shapeless nothingness. That's not where the narrative begins, not in Genesis 1, 2, but rather with the earth or with the land looking like a wilderness, looking like a desert better. Now the earth was desolate and empty. Or better, or maybe another way of doing it, the earth was a deserted desert. But by day 3, God, the gardener, has turned desolation into fruitfulness. Listen to verse 11. Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and trees that bear fruit. And it was so. In other words, God turns the desert into paradise. He is a gardener. Now, just a passing comment here. The creation stories of Genesis 1 and 2 make most sense if read in the context of a binary opposition between barrenness, desolation on one side, and fruitfulness and fertility on the other. The creation stories are less about creation out of nothing, although they include that, and more about environmental transformation from desert to garden. So if the first humanity is created in the image of God and according to his likeness, then they too should turn desolation into fruitfulness, and of course by implication, they should not turn fruitfulness into desolation. So it's not at all surprising that Adam's role as gardener echoes or mirrors God's garden planting that see described in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 as well. I wonder whether this orientation also helps us to make sense of God's command to the first humans to subdue the earth and to rule over it. Adam's dominion over the earth, this is where I come back to the announced topic. What is dominion? Adam's dominion over the earth is not meant to be oppressive or destructive, but it's meant to echo God's dominion seen in creation. And it's a dominion that transforms desolation into fertility. In short, Adam was meant to rule and subdue the earth as a gardener rules and subdues his garden, by working over it, by working it and taking care of it. Some extrapolations. What significance does any of this have to ecology in the 21st century? Let me suggest some extrapolations from the text that we have been considering. I'm actually avoiding the word application because I'm not pretending to apply the text meaning. Rather, I'm offering some brief reflections on how we in the 21st century might live in continuity with the worldview assumed by these opening chapters of Genesis. Just a couple of points. I wonder if the model of Gardner provides a helpful way of thinking about the environment in the 21st century, of our relationship to it. It is not a rapacious model. A gardener cares for the environment. He has to. Nor is it a green for green's sake model. It's a model that recognizes a legitimate utilitarian use of the environment, but in a way that values and even delights in the preservation of the environment. Second extrapolation. I've argued that the original humanity's role as gardener points to their royal image-bearing status. Thus, the careful protection and enhancing of the earth's fertility, its abundance and productivity, was viewed as a royal activity. To extrapolate from this, I think that we should see in modern attempts to preserve and enhance our physical environment at least a dim reflection of our original glory as humans, and that there is something noble, something royal, something dominion-restoring in the work of environmentalists, and even more so in the case of Christian environmentalists. My third and final extrapolation invites a connection to the gospel. In John's gospel, we discover the climactic moment of the story, the resurrection of Jesus, which is the beginning of the new creation, takes place in a garden. John tells us in chapter 19, verse 41, that at the place where Jesus was crucified was a garden, and in the garden there was a new tomb in which the body of Jesus was laid. What this means is that the new creation, the resurrection of Jesus from the dust of death, like the old creation, begins in a garden. In this setting, Mary Magdalene meets the risen Christ, but she does not recognize him because, as John tells us, she was thinking or supposing that he was the gardener. But I can't help wondering if John, ever the master of irony, smiled as he wrote this, because Mary, in her confusion, actually got it right. In fact, the man she saw was the gardener, the second Adam, the man who would one day bring all of creation into order, harmony, and abundance. But a bit more on that tomorrow.